You want answers? I think I'm entitled.
You want answers?
I want the truth! You can't handle the truth!
Dave Hodges is as mad as hell, and he's not going to take it anymore.
I'd like to help you, Doctor, if I really, really would, but the feeling in my head, it's too much and it's no good. I'm standing in a window, so I'm shouting through the water, and I'd like to give the information. That's my feeling, but blood makes noise. It's ringing in my ear, blood makes noise. And I can barely hear you in the thickening of fear.
Common sense is not so common. This is the Common Sense Show with Dave Hodges.
Welcome to hour number two, and you are indeed listening to the Common Sense Show, and I am your host, Dave Hodges, and we are freeing America, one enslaved mind at a time. Our thanks go out to Dr. Ted Brewer for joining us and covering a wide variety of topics, And we have a first-time guest that we're going to get to in just a moment, Charlie Robinson, who's written a really interesting book. And we'll be there in just a moment. But I want to kind of clean up one thing you heard at the top of the hour. You heard the Virtual Shield ad. And I have to tell you that you guys need to jump on this right now. Facebook and these other social medias are doing really bad things with your data. Their VPN captures have gone to a new level. Now, you know Virtual Shield. They're ex-Intel guys. They won't even come on this show. They're so covert. I'm serious. They love what I do in promoting it, but they won't even talk to me. They go through an intermediary. And I understand why. When you're going against the NSA and some of these real powerful corporate entities, you know, I would be a little queasy, too. But let me tell you what they're doing. They are really concerned about social media capturing data and compromising you and your financial security. This is really, really bad. And YouTube and Google and Facebook, they don't care about you. They don't care if you're the victim of identity theft. They could care less. Well, these guys can stop it in its tracks. And they have all new protocols. And they're putting them on sale until the 28th. And this is what I wanted to really emphasize to you, because that ad you're hearing is a stock ad at the top of the hour. This is the latest update. 28th of this month, you can take 35% off. That's right. Just use the coupon code Hodges35. You can't afford to be without this. I mean, the whole process starts at $4.95 a month. Then you can upgrade. And I'm telling you right now, for 3 days, it's 35% off. And this stuff is good. Listen, you don't want your threat matrix score to go up. You do not want your identity being sold, and this is exactly what's going on. I understand Fox is supposed to be coming out with a story on that this week. Well, I got tipped off on this, and I tell you, the Virtual Shield people are way ahead of this, and they went through one of my contacts to tell me, tell Dave out there that we're going to go give a big discount because we want to beat Fox to the punch, but we also want to make sure that as many people get protected as quickly as possible, because social media people are bad, bad people. You heard Ted and I talk about them in the last hour. No regard for you whatsoever. So anyway, I need to get that off and tell you, don't forget Steve Quayle's conference in September. It's going to sell out. Go to thecommonsenseshow.com, click on the tab for that conference in Branson, and go ahead and register before the opportunities are gone, because I do want to meet all of you, and I am going to be there. Well, here we are in hour number two, and we have a first-time guest on, and I'm really happy to have him on. He's living in my old stomping grounds, the Mile High City, and I get a little homesick when I say that. I love Denver, but I'll never move back because I don't have to shovel heat. But Denver's a great, great town, although the liberals have kind of taken that over, but it's still what you make it. Anyway, Charlie Robinson is his name, and his book is called The Octopus of Global Control, and he describes it as a controversial book that blends quotes from over 500 experts and participants in some of the most important moments in history, and mixes in a little bit of humor with it, too, kind of like Josh Coy, you know, like good friend Josh. Well, Charlie, I'm really glad that you could join us. Welcome to the show. First time on, and I think my audience is really going to enjoy this.
Thanks for having me, Dave. I'm also a listener, so it is very nice to be on the other side here. And yes, in Denver, you do have to shovel a little bit of snow, but that's okay. I can I can deal with that now.
Well, I'll take this opportunity to say hello to my niece and sister who are listening in right now. Guys, I love you. Great seeing my niece last week. Thanks, guys. Anyway, Charlie, what prompted you to write this book, The Octopus of Global Control? And I love the title.
Oh, thank you. Well, what prompted me was really John Perkins, to be completely honest. He wrote a book called Confessions of an Economic Hitman. I was getting ready to take off on a trip in 2007, and a friend of mine said, you should take, I don't even think he offered, he didn't ask me if I wanted it. He said, read this book. And so I just threw it in my bag. So, it changed my life, and I'm sure a lot of your listeners have read Confessions of an Economic Hitman. So, and it wasn't so much that it was all brand new to me, but it added the final piece of the puzzle. So, like, I understood 9/11. I'd like to say I understood it on the morning of 9/11, but that would not exactly be true. But I got it. I got it a couple years after the fact. And I understood how that worked, and I knew the wars were phony, and I understood that the media was corrupted, and I got all that. But when I read his book, and it explained how the economic system, and he considered himself, they called himself an economic hitman. He worked for a company called MADE, which is the equivalent of like a Halliburton or a Bechtel, like a multinational engineering company. And they would go to these countries, and they would propose their services. They'd say, hey, listen, it'd be great if you guys had a dam here, if you had a hydroelectric power plant, because you guys are in the Stone Age now, but if we put up this dam, then you guys would have electricity, you guys would be able to read, your kids would be able to read at night, you would have, you know, all these benefits, and the price tag is only going to be this. And so, you know, they get a couple guys in charge, and they say, by the way, you are going to make a fortune because we're going to make sure that you're well taken care of. So the decision gets made, and they sign off on the erection of this new, say, a hydroelectric power plant. Well, the money then is created. It's loaned out by the World Bank, but it doesn't go to this country. It never actually flows to the country. It goes from the World Bank, which is a corrupt organization, directly into the multinational engineering firms, and they start to build this plant, and so the clock starts ticking, so to speak, on the debt. Well, the mathematics that were given to these people to show them how this was all going to pencil out were broken from the beginning, and that was intentional. So the plant gets built a couple years after schedule at a price that's three times what they quoted. And it's doomed to fail, and it looks like a gigantic accident, but it's not. And so when they can't pay this, when they can't deliver on their debts, then they say, well, listen, guys, you know, it's no different from the old loan sharks. You know, you guys got a problem here. You owe us some money. So you either vote our way in the next UN resolution, which is one thing that could happen, or you privatize your lumber industry, and our buddies are going to pick up that. They're going to buy that at a discounted price. So you start to see how the game is totally rigged, and it's not accidental. So once I read that book, once I understood that financial component, geopolitical financial component, it all started to make more sense to me. I understood why there was a first world and a third world. No one ever explained where the second world was, but you understood now why these countries were doomed to poverty. And it was sad, and it was horrible. And I think if that had just been the book, that wouldn't have been enough. But the fact that John Perkins sort of turned his life around and became a gigantic advocate for indigenous people in Central America and South America, and he has, yes, he's sort of repented for his sins. But that, to me, that book, life-changing, for sure.
Yeah, that was for me, too. That's when I really got the idea that globalism was a lot farther along than I thought.
Yeah, for sure. And So I'm looking at this. I'm watching. I'm now starting to understand how this plays out, and that turns me on to more of the financial rigging of the system. You sort of, as kids, you kind of know that there's something a little funky with the banks, in part because they never really teach you much about it in school. But then, as I got into this, through his book, and then I started to look at the World Bank, and I started to look at the Federal Reserve, and then understanding, well, the Federal Reserve is a government bank. Well, that's not true at all. Well, the Federal Reserve is a quasi-government bank. Well, that's not true either. So that's what I had been told. So as you start to peel away these lies, you realize, what's the benefit? Why would somebody lie about this? Why would you call it the Federal Reserve and then, but it's not federal? It's, you know, as people have said,
I know the answer to that question. I know why. I got my hand up in the back of the room here, but yeah. You know, they're trying to fake you out.
Yeah, exactly.
Because
they don't have it's federal.
Yeah, it's not federal, and nor do they have any reserves.
Right. It's such false advertising on a number of levels, but it almost seems appropriate for as rigged and as corrupt as the banking system is, for it to be called the Federal Reserve, but it to not actually be federal and have no reserves seems actually quite appropriate.
Yeah, it is amazing, but okay, so this octopus thing. It's a very descriptive term, and I kind of know what you mean by it, but let's explain it. Why choose the word octopus?
There have been quite a few people that have used this metaphor. But let me, when the idea for the book came around, the idea was that I wanted the words from the people that were involved in these really important, pivotal moments in not just American history, but in world history. I wanted to hear what was coming from their mouth. So a lot of the quotes are from people that are very important. They're politicians, they're, you know, Rockefellers, and there's people, you know, people that had a lot of influence. Some of them are from George Carlin, who, frankly, maybe didn't have as much money as Rockefellers, but these days I think has probably more influence. His words carry a lot more weight, in part because they're true. So I took this blending, but when it came down to the one quote that really sort of summarized and to me really embodies the book, it's this. It's a little lengthy, but it's worth it. So the real menace of our republic is the invisible government, which, like a giant octopus, sprawls its slimy legs over our cities, states, and nation. To depart from mere generalizations, let me say that at the head of the octopus are the Rockefeller Standard Oil interests and a small group of powerful banking houses, generally referred to as the international bankers. This little coterie of powerful international bankers virtually run the United States government for their own selfish purposes. They practically control both parties, write political platforms, make cat paws of party leaders, use the leading men of private organizations, and resort to every device to place in nomination for high public office only such candidates as will be amenable to the dictates of corrupt big business. These international bankers and Rockefeller Standard Oil interests control the majority of the newspapers and magazines in this country. They use the columns of these papers to club into submission or drive out of office public officials who refuse to do the bidding of the powerful corrupt cliques which compose the invisible government. It operates under cover of a self-created screen and seizes our executive officers, legislative bodies, schools, courts, newspapers, and every agency created for the public protection. Now, that was from John Francis Hyland. He's the mayor of New York City in 1922. And honestly, what has changed, with the exception of the name Rockefeller/Standard Oil, everything else about that statement is totally true, and nothing's changed. So I find that to be important. Obviously, the octopus is sort of this image, and I think a lot of times it's this sort of evil-looking, very ominous animal. But the thing about it is it's one of the most intelligent animals on the planet. It has the ability to stay and fight if it needs to. It has the ability to spray ink and disappear quickly. It can change its texture, change its color. It can change a bunch of things about it. So it actually, if you think about it, it's perfect for the invisible government. You know, they've got this deceptive look to them. They can look or they can act however they think they need to look or act to either put themselves in a position to defend themselves or to attack something. So, you know, it's a great analogy. It's a great animal that sort of matches this. And but like I said, I'm not the first person to bring this, you know, to use this animal to describe the people running the show.
Well, Charlie, in your metaphor, and you went on to explain with the Rockefellers, I caught reference here to the Rockefeller family. I think it was in the Hyland quote. Who's taken David Rockefeller's place? Anybody?
Oh, boy. Well, I would have said the big new Brzezinski, but he's in that same group of dead people that are running the show. Is it the bankers? I don't know. I mean, really,
I don't know either. That's why I asked.
If you want to be honest about it, the people that are really in control, we might not actually even know their names. Yes, we know Bill Gates, and he is a scumbag in his own right. There's no doubt about that. But there are probably people whose names we've never heard of. In fact, if you're really going to be the best at this, it would be in your best interest to remain slightly anonymous.
I would agree, because it keeps the hordes from showing up outside your house. I've interviewed Vance Davis, who's formerly of the NSA. I've interviewed him a number of times, been a friend of mine for over 25 years. And Vance tells me there's a council of nine behind all these names that we know, the Rockefellers, the Rothschilds, and so forth. Have you ever heard of the Council of Nine?
I've heard of the Committee of 300. Yeah. No, I haven't heard of the Council of Nine. I would imagine that there are... I think lately, like within the last 10 years, we've started to hear, you know, the Bilderberg. I mean, for people that were into the alternative media, they've known about Bilderberg for a long time. But I'd say people sort of on the edges are starting to hear about the Bilderberg and groups like that. And there's this assumption that there has to be a big meeting for everyone to get together and decide on how they want to run things. And that might be true for the details of things, but in an overall, that meeting is probably irrelevant, only because the people that are running the show, they know what's in their best interest. They know what needs to happen to make, you know, they need to know what they need to do to make that happen. And the other people that are in positions of power, they understand that as well. I don't know that a big meeting necessarily has to happen. I know that it does. I mean, I know that it does in terms of Bilderberg and Davos and places and things like that. I think Davos is maybe a little bit more mainstream, but let's not kid ourselves. There's a lot of wheeling and dealing that goes on there. But in general, the big meeting where everybody gets together to plot to rule the world, it doesn't necessarily have to happen as long as these people understand what they need to do in order to keep their positions in power. And that typically involves, you know, controlling the money supply and creating, deflecting attention off of them and onto somebody else. And usually that happens in the form of a war. And maybe get into the details through Bilderberg, where people come together with the media and they say, all right, well, how are we going to concoct this whole thing? You know, what's on the agenda for 2022 or 2021 or whatever? Who's going to be the boogeyman? We've had Russia the last couple years, but who's the new boogeyman going to be? And I'm sure that gets worked out in those meetings.
Well, there always has to be a boogeyman. You're so right to point that out. Well, when you, in your book, when you talk about the octopus, we're talking about tentacles that come out from the body.
Yeah.
Other than the Federal Reserve, what are some of these other tentacles that reach out and try to enslave?
Yeah. So I broke it down into eight different tentacles to control. So we'll call it military, governmental, covert, physical control, financial control, media control, obviously, and then spiritual and scientific control. And some of them, they overlap. You know, they are a bit of a Venn diagram. So it's not that one is separate from the other. The media control, obviously, we see that. That's pretty obvious. And as well as things like the military control. You can turn on the news, you can see how these work in concert with one another. You can't have the military control. We can't have the authority or the approval for military control without the media control. So they work together. You might have things that are sort of an offshoot, like the covert control tentacle, which would be things like false flags and passing off drills that are simulating events, like, I don't know, shootings in different places. Then we've got physical control, and so I define physical control as things like, like your friend at the NSA, the TSA, the education system, Common Core, things like that. So talking about sort of the shaping of the opinions of people through things like, I don't know, the rise of private prisons, the rise of, you know, Common Core in schools, which I think is maybe another form of a prison. I don't know. There's an interesting...
It is a mental prison. It does. It kills creativity. Listen, my son had to go through this nonsense of the way they solve math problems, which is totally limiting creativity. Absolutely correct.
It's insane. And then when you find out, I think there must be something to having so much money that you've bought everything you can buy, because you see people like, you know, like Rockefeller was heavily involved in financing education, Carnegie as well. But now you see, you know, Common Core, and that's the Gates Foundation. So I think Bill Gates maybe is in that range where he has made enough money, he has bought enough of everything, and he's gotten in the point, well, what's my legacy? Well, I want to control, I want to really leave my mark. Well, if you really, really want to leave your mark on society, get a hold of the education system, because you can screw people up. So when you see the Common Core, if you're somebody listening to this that, and you don't have a kid that's school age, or maybe you know it's something that you're not familiar with, look into Common Core. It is fascinating. I mean, it's infuriating, but it's also fascinating too, because it is the only explanation for it is that they are intentionally trying to confuse kids. There's no logical explanation other than that, because when you see what they've done to the education system, you really can be left with no other alternative but that. You can find a guy named Duke Pesta who talks about that. You can find his videos on YouTube. Watch some of his. It's fascinating. He dismantles Common Core in a way that's very witty. And I found when I started looking into the education aspect of this, I found a guy named John Taylor Gatto. Now, he's an older guy, and I'm sure a lot of your listeners have known who he was for a long, long time. He's new to me, and I started watching his videos and listening to him. He's fascinating. But he talks about education. He talks about how it really wasn't that much of a stretch to take the education system and model it on prison. And talked about why the school, you know, why the classes are set up in a way where you've got the lines and lines of desks, you know, in a row, and how that's not accidental, how that's intentional, and the fact that there's a bell going off, at, you know, in between classes or at the end of the day, and it's very, you know, it's very Fred Flintstone, yabba dabba doo, the bell goes off, you slide down the brontosaurus tail, and you're out of there, and it is. You know, his belief, and it is mine as well, that is intentional, that they've created the classroom situation to get these kids ready for a lifetime of working on the assembly line. But even that's gone now, so I don't know what they're getting them ready for now. It used to be that you would get them ready to go work at the mill, you know, or the factory.
How about compliance?
But now that the factories and the mills are gone, I don't know what you're getting them ready for now. Probably just a lifetime of nothing. Because if you learn how to do math by Common Core, you have a life filled with nothing in your future, for sure. You will be so confused. Life will just be a gigantic frustration. So,
well, I think a lot of it, you said what's left with factories gone and so forth. I think a lot of it, Charlie, is obedience. I wrote an article about this a couple of, maybe 4 years ago, and it was about some of the discipline practices at elementary schools. In one elementary school in Riverside, California, the teacher would blow the whistle, and she'd raise her hand, and all the kids on the playground had to kneel. And I thought, how Pavlovian is that? And then another one, a guy actually went to jail because he was in a hurry to get his daughter to a dentist appointment. The line was forever. And so he jumped out and walked up to her and grabbed her and said, "Okay, let's go. Dad, I got to wait for you to pull up here." "No, no, no, we're going to go now. I'm pulling out of line." And they went and got the student resource officer, and they arrested him for disorderly conduct. It's that kind of obedience and compliance that I think a lot of the schools do. Now, look, a lot of administrators and teachers, they're not working from that mentality. But you might be right about the system. And I do agree with you. The early schools were, no question, set up to emulate the factory system. No question about it.
Yeah. It, it, it's, it, that took work. You know, that was, so it wasn't that they all just decided this was a good way to do it. You could tell that that came from above and has been put, you know, as an edict to the schools. This is how we're doing it. These days now, you've got safe spaces, which is preparing kids for a lifetime of being sissies. Yeah, exactly. Yeah. Whining.
Oh, I didn't get my way.
I don't know.
Safe room. Didn't get my way. I can't take it. And I got to tell you, there is this millennial attitude that's out there today. And by millennial attitude, I mean self-entitled, don't have to struggle, don't want to be challenged, don't want to have to work. We want rising minimum wage so we don't have to start at the bottom where everyone else started.
I mean, on the one hand, like, I can understand where people say, hey, well, listen, you know, we need to write the minimum wage needs to come up because we've got, you know, because it's hard to make a living. I get all that. But be very careful, because there becomes a tipping point at which, as you get up a little bit higher and higher and higher, you start to see companies say, how do I get around this? How can I get rid of you people and replace them with a touch screen? You know, and so you're seeing the McDonald's, you know, the fast food industry pushing for a rise in minimum wage. And I'm in favor of that to an extent, but people need to be cognizant of the fact that as you do that, remember, they fight you the whole way, and the employers start looking for ways to go around you. And if they can find a way to go around you, they're going to go around you. So as you see taxi drivers now, you've got Uber and Lyft, and you've got those, you know, sort of pressing on them, then it doesn't take much to see a little bit further down and say, well, you know, there's going to be a time when all of you guys get replaced because they're going to have self-driving cars and things like that. Now, we can debate whether or not that's a good thing, but that's coming based on the fact that, based on the fact that technology is improving and companies will always be looking for a way to reduce costs. And if they can reduce costs by reducing overhead or payroll employees, believe me, that they're going to be looking for a way to do that. So,
let's carry this out to its logical end here. You've got replacements of blue-collar workers, you know, manual labor jobs, and whatever it is.
Yeah.
And you've got all this AI replacement going on. Okay, that's the way the corporations are solving their problem, dealing with these people. But what about governments? I mean, you're going to have excess people with nothing to do, and there's nothing more dangerous to a totalitarian regime like our burgeoning one than idle people with too much time on their hands. Is this why the globalists about two or three decades ago started talking about we need 90% less people on the planet?
I would think that plays a part. They've always had an interest in that. I mentioned in my book about the Georgia Guidestones, and I described them as Stonehenge plus the Ten Commandments plus Waffle House. And it's a weird sort of idea that you have come up with all of these ways to reduce the population. And I understand that they do this in a way. They sort of shield this with, we're just looking out for the environment. We're just looking out for the environment. And so if someone is looking out for the environment, honestly, how much can you hate them, right? So you say, well, they're looking out for the environment. So Ted Turner is a prime example of someone like this. He's actually been, you know, the assumption is that he financed the Georgia Guidestones because he's a Georgia native and he's a psychopath and he has a lot of money. So
true.
He's a hypocritical father of five who is saying that everyone should have one kid. So, of course, Ted Turner is the logical person for this. So that takes us down the path towards what is obviously a gigantic topic, and that is global warming. Now, anytime I see a coordinated effort by the media, when the media is 100% in agreement on one particular thing, that makes me very suspicious. So They are all in agreement about global warming. Now, is there global warming? I don't know. It was global warming, then they changed it to change the name to climate change, which, if you think about it, is a total Orwellian doublespeak word. It's like climate change. Of course, there's a climate, and it changes. It changes day to day. It changes season to season. It changes based on sun cycles and all those things. But you take all that aside, and you go back and you look at what most people don't realize is that the there's a group, but you want to talk about a group of globalist psychopaths. In 1971, the Club of Rome. Are you familiar with that? With that group That's of with familiar. That name,
right? If you're familiar with the Committee of 300, the Club of Rome
yep.
is closely related. In fact, the author.
Yes.
The author's name has jumped out of my head, and I've interviewed him. Gosh. Anyway, he...
we've got...
John...
It was a Rockefeller and Brzezinski organization.
Exactly. And the Club of Rome, exactly. And it's connected to the Trilateral Commission and the Committee of 300.
Exactly.
Yeah,
exactly.
Yeah,
so what did they do in
1971?
So in 1971, this is a quote that came from their committee, and this might make a little bit more sense of the whole climate change / global warming concept. So it says, this is from them. The common enemy of humanity is man. In searching for a new enemy to unite us, we came up with the idea that pollution, the threat of global warming, water shortages, famine, and the like would fit the bill. All these dangers are caused by human intervention, and it is only through changed attitudes and behavior that they can be overcome. The real enemy, then, is humanity itself. We believe humanity requires a common motivation, namely, a common adversary, in order to realize world government. It does not matter if this common enemy is a real one or one invented for the purpose. So... if that's coming from me, it means very little. When that's coming from David Rockefeller and the big new Brzezinski and that whole group, that's a huge problem, because you go back, you look, this is 1971. So this is a group that has been in operation for damn near half a century, and they're telling you in 71 that we have decided that the idea that pollution, the threat of global warming, water shortages and famine would fit the bill for getting people towards a world government. Now, does that mean that climate change is fake? No, doesn't necessarily mean that, but it's something that I bet most people aren't familiar with. So when you hear that, and when you understand that those guys had real power and real influence, and that that's what they're pushing for, and that in their paperwork, in their organization, they are talking about that they're going to, that it doesn't matter whether this common enemy is real or one invented for the purpose, you have to at least consider that it might have been invented for the purpose.
It was. I mean, I'm convinced it was. And first of all, it's an outgrowth. I'm sure you're familiar with Brzezinski's book, Between Two Ages, The Technotronic Era.
Yes.
Because that dovetails right into the quote that you just cited.
Yeah, yeah, and it comes from that group of people that sort of adhere to the philosophy of, like, listen, the ends justify the means. Yes, we're going to, some people are going to die from this, but the world's going to be a much better place. Well, the world's going to be a much easier place to control, which is what they mean. It doesn't mean it's going to be a better place. It means it's going to put them in a better position to control it, because that's how they think. They talk about it. Even Brzezinski talks about how it's much easier now to kill a million people than to control a million people. Well, only psychopaths think about stuff like that. Like, really sit down and say, is it easier for me today to control people or to kill them? Like, that might be something you would talk about if everyone was drinking in a hot tub, maybe. But, like, these guys sit around. This is like what happens at the board meetings. Like, they need to get down to business. This is on their agenda. Like, let's figure it out. If it's really easier to kill a million people than to control them, like, to us, it's theoretical. To them, like, they want practical knowledge. They want information about this, because they're planning to put this in you know, they're planning to put these things in play. And it's funny that, but now we're starting to see a lot of them sort of die off in their 90s, of course. They manage to live longer than the rest of us, and I don't know if that's because they're draining blood from people at Bohemian Grove, although I wouldn't put it past any of them. So, insane. But now, you know, you asked about that. Who's the next generation? Well, I mean, you're going to have to put the technical. I think it's changing. I think what gives you power and control these days is changing into data. I think data is the control. So you'd have to put guys like, you know, Larry Page and Sergey Brin and Mark Zuckerberg and you know, Travis Kalanick, all these guys that are in positions of great control in data companies. And have billions of dollars, you'd have to sort of put them on that list. And especially when somebody starts a foundation, that's a pretty good indication that they're up to no good. So when, like, Mark Zuckerberg says, I'm giving all my money away into this foundation. No, you're not. This is a tax shield. Like, come on, stop. You're not giving it away, Mark Zuckerberg. You're using, you know, avoidance techniques to not pay tax, which I'm totally fine with, by the way. But I just think that it's ridiculous that they talk about how they're just going to give it away now. They've reached a point in their life, Dave, when they have so much money, they want to help humanity now. Oh, now you want to help humanity. Great. Sorry, don't believe you, Bill Gates. Buying it.
Boy, I hope you're around with those beliefs when I want to sell a distressed property.
I criticize the TSA, and now I have, you want to talk about a lifetime of agony in my future. I just dread going every time I go through there. I know I'm just on some, database, and they go, "Oh, yeah, books, black and blue and dumb all over." Is the chapter of the name of the chapter that you guys wrote about TSA? We're gonna have to have you in another room for additional screening as we get the blue gloves ready.
Charlie, there's always a silver lining, though. I was in the Phoenix airport last March, 2017. And I made a smart aleck comment about TSA. And this guy next to me, very elderly gentleman, he said, "You know, I just kind of go to the line where they're going to have the female." And I go, "Well, why is that?" He says, "I like the TSA. It's the only time a woman gets close enough to me anymore to touch me."
Yeah, I make them work for it. I figure, hey, you know what? Want to go through the, you know, through the machine, but let's do the hand pat down, and you know, I'm going to make you earn it. How about that? Let's do it right out here in public so everybody can watch too. Why not?
I wonder how many times they get asked for their number. If they were to perform those activities out in public, they'd all get arrested for second degree sexual assault. That's what's amazing.
Exactly.
Let's go back to one of the other tentacles in your book, and that's the media. I have to tell you, I'm in a personal war right now with social media, which basically is kind of like the bastard redheaded stepchild of the mainstream media that's getting their butts kicked. So now social media is trying to step up and take over. And because we were dumb enough in the beginning to use their monopolistic platforms, we're getting our butts kicked.
Yeah. Well, and I'm seeing things... seeing things like not necessarily social media, in terms of like the Facebooks and Twitters, but YouTube as a platform. You have 93,000 subscribers. What happens if your channel disappears tomorrow because some vice president at YouTube has decided that maybe your brand of information doesn't really line up with what they think is the right way things should be handled, and you disappear. Your channel disappears. Now, I heard Ritzy Allen's channel disappeared this week, and that, to me, is alarming. First of all, I'm a fan of his show, and I can't stand stuff like that. So in the event that your YouTube channel, which with your 93,000 subscribers, does happen to disappear, I hope that every single one of us, I include myself in that group, picks up the phone and called YouTube and said, "This is, we're done with this. This is ridiculous. Yes, you're a private company. I get it. You guys get to make your rules. That's fine. But changing the rules like this on people is very short-sighted. And, you know, the history is littered with examples of companies going down this path, and then all of a sudden, sort of a silent change happens, and next thing you know, everyone's like, I'm not really interested in this anymore. Like, oh, we've moved on to something else. And YouTube better watch themselves, because that's coming for them. It might, you know, the tipping point might be, you know, a little bit further on, because they have such a dominant share of the social video sharing platform industry. But that isn't to say that couldn't go away. You look at Google Plus when they were trying to do trying to be Facebook, you know, sort of force people into their social media platform. It failed miserably. And so that is an example that they are, you know, someone like Google by default, you know, YouTube, which they own, they're not indestructible. They're not impervious to changes. And I would hope that should something like that happen, everybody would rise up. Even, you know, frankly, even if the Common Sense Show isn't your favorite show, just on principle, you should rise up and fight against that anyway. Because, you know, the old saying, you know, first they came for the Jews and I was not a Jew, and then they came for the trade unionists. And I have that quote in my book as well. And so that could very easily happen in a situation like this, in a digital sense, that they come for the Jews and you're not a Jew, so you say nothing, and then the next thing you know, there's nobody to speak for you. And I certainly hope that doesn't happen, but I think we might be going down that path in terms of the social media component of it. But there's one thing we often seem to willingly forget, and that is we have the power because we have the numbers. And if we withdraw the numbers, if we withdraw our eyeballs or our ad dollars or our dollars, things can change, and they can change quickly. So we must never forget that. We really, really do have a whole lot more power than we are led to believe. And it is in their interest to convince us that we don't have power. So remember that as well. And next time you see a TV special or you know, a news story, and they're talking about how, you know, should they happen to mention that we don't have the ability to change some things, that should be a red flag. That should get you, you know, thinking, oh, they don't want us to change them. There's something there that they're trying to convince us that we don't have the power to stand up to, and that's not the case.
Well, Charlie, they're willing to take a hit for a long period of time, and I'm going to reference Clear Channel Communication and their former 1,500 stations. They lose tremendous amounts of money, and they lose lots of money because people aren't buying their BS, so they go elsewhere, but they're willing to fund it to keep the illusion that they're still in control and try to break the resistance psychologically. I've seen it over and over.
And it's so the first chapter that I have within my media section is called Broken News. And I think that we have been participants in it. We certainly have been witnesses to it. I've watched the news change over the last, you know, 2 decades. And I think if I were to rewind all the way back to what really did it, this is going to sound ridiculous because it's such a trivial topic, but I think the O.J. chase might have been a pivotal part there, because and this is the reason why I say that. I was living in Los Angeles at the time. I was at USC, and so I was, you know, that was fresh. That was all over the media. But I was at Dodger Stadium watching a game, and the O.J. chase was going on, and this is how I knew that it had gotten out of control. When you're in line to buy food, like a hot dog, they have TVs mounted up above there so you're not watching the game. Obviously, you've gone in to grab a hot dog really quick, so you don't miss the game. You can watch it. The TVs were all turned to the O.J. chase. And I thought, well, wow, I didn't even know those TVs had the ability to show any other channel than, I don't know, the Dodger game that was happening right then. I just assumed that that's all it was. And I saw that, and I thought, this is insanity. And
I got to
so
tell you where I was
on,
at during that time.
Yeah, where were you?
You were at the baseball game.
Yeah.
This almost saved me a lot of money. I was in the shopping mall, and I was buying my wife some jewelry, and she was all excited, and I was really kind of happy to do it for her. But then the O.J. case came on, and Chase, and we watched and watched and watched. And I mean, and we sat down and watched, and we were mesmerized. And then she said, honey, the stores are only open for another half hour. We better go get it. Women never forget. But that was my experience at that. Yeah, it was mesmerizing, and then the juice was loose and got off. And I do agree with you.
Yep.
It really changed the way a lot of people looked at media.
Yeah. Yeah, it became all about breaking news. And so, you know, we have, I think somebody came out and said last week that they think that the media likes the idea of school shootings. And I think they might be right. As insane and as disrespectful and as horrible as that sounds, there are some executives sitting up there going, the ratings are great, man. People are finally watching the news. So then it becomes, where is that line where the news is invented for the purpose of being filmed? You know, and is it all fake? Is it fake news? Is it all manufactured news? Well, I think it is manufactured on some level. I think the vast majority of it is. And that is when you go to when you watch a funny video compilation of that somebody's put together that shows all the news channels saying the exact same thing, like the Easter Bunny springing into Easter Sunday, something or other. They've got this funny clip, like an unusual set of words strung together. And then you see it played over and over and over and over and over again by 100 different media organizations, and you realize, well, they're obviously reading off of a script. So if they're reading off a script for this, are they reading off a script for everything? And that becomes, I think that's a legitimate question to ask. So, yes, the media is busted. The news is totally corrupted. It's owned by too few people. There's too much writing on it. So is it manufactured? And I think that the answer is becoming quite obvious. It is manufactured, and that isn't up for debate. It's just a matter of degree how much of it is manufactured, and why are certain issues covered that seemingly have very little interest to somebody. Meanwhile, other things that are happening maybe in your community or in your state are completely just avoided and not happening at all. And you're like, why isn't anybody talking about this? So you have a responsibility. You're in media. You have a responsibility to talk about the things that are of interest, you know, of interest to you or of interest to your listeners. If you don't, they won't listen. That doesn't seem to necessarily be the case with the mainstream media. Or like you said, Clear Channel has the money to sort of ride that out and wait that out and see to see if they can, how long they can go spending their money covering stories the way they want to cover them with no accountability to anybody. I mean, you would think by now that people would have turned all of that off, and I'm sure they have to a certain extent. But it has definitely been a weird thing to watch over the last couple of years as these number of media stations sort of consolidate, and yet the craziest stories tend to make it on there. And then it's not even a debate about whether or not the story is right. It's just everybody is trying to discuss whether, you know, how wrong this person is, or, you know, it just seems like very controlled topics of discussion, and then the debate between them is very limited. So.
Well, I don't think it's much debate. There's a lot of propaganda. I'll give you a case in point, the Florida shooting, and they trot out kids with scripted questions. That's a rehearsal.
Yeah.
That's not a news report. That's a rehearsal.
Yeah, and that's weird. You know, that's strange. Now, I understand if there's kids that have been traumatized and they want to maybe help keep them on task, or, you know, sort of keep them going down the right path. But we're talking about scripted answers, scripted questions being asked at these quote town halls. I don't know. I see that stuff, and it stinks like non-journalism or fraud. Really, I mean, none of it seems real to me. But the problem is how it's a race to see if as this curve of actual news is falling. The question is, can the stupidity of the people watching it fall at a rate that's greater to keep them dumber than the obvious tampering with their news? So they're never smart enough to ever actually figure it out. And that comes across as sounding a bit, like a jerkish thing to say, but in reality, they have been manipulating the food, and they have been adding things to medicines, and they have been spraying things in our air. They have been intentionally dumbing down the population. That is, sounds bad, sounds like a mean thing to say, but it's sadly the truth. And so the question is why? If your goal is to make people stupid, why? I think the answer becomes so that they'll be too dumb to figure out what is really going on. And that is, of course, alarming. And you guys have been talking about that for decades. I would imagine at least a decade you've been sort of sounding the alarm on this and making great strides, of course, but I think that the rate of stupidity is exceeding. I don't know if it is. It's to a point where we can pull up from this, or if it is in a death spiral where that movie Idiocracy that was written by Mike Judge from Beavis and Butthead and Office Space has jokingly, people have come out. He's come out and said, "I didn't know I was writing a documentary." And I don't know if you're familiar with that, but you'll get a good kick when you watch the State of the Union address. And the story is anyway. The guy falls asleep in this chamber, and he's woken up 500 years later, and he's the smartest guy in the country, and he sees the State of the Union, and it basically looks kind of like the State of the Union right now. A bunch of juiced up lunatics, standing up and applauding for no reason,
We got to go to the break here. We're right up against it. But we're going to open up the phone lines for part of the third hour. Charlie's going to stay over, and excuse me here as I try to muddle through my version of the flu. Ted doesn't get it. I do, and you heard it. But I'll deal with it over the break. We'll see you in hour number three.